This edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on the 29th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show in association with Mubi. Dressed in our Burberry trenches this week, as we sneak through the back streets of chilly London, it's espionage and spy capers in the cinema.
Hitchcock is making the point that you see in a lot of this fiction that the thin veneer of civilization that allows us to operate as ordinary people in a collective where we don't really know everybody, in a big city like New York City, can in fact be shattered very easily.
We'll investigate the anti-bond in Michael Caine's 1965 British classic, The Ypres File. And traversing the Atlantic, we'll assess the striking contrast between British and American treatments of espionage on screen. It's a deathly dose of intrigue, mystery, and suspense as we dive into the spy drama today on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of cinema on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House today, and I'd like to welcome my guest, the social scientist and author Toby Miller, who is the writer of a book called Spy Screen, which is very pertinent because, of course, today we are taking a covert journey through espionage in the cinema, from Michael Caine's 1965 take in the Ypres File to the classic Alfred Hitchcock caper Saboteur from 1942. Toby, welcome to The Cinema Show. We'll discuss both of those films soon, and being in London, it would clearly be remiss of us not to mention James Bond. But first, perhaps, maybe just start us off by sharing some of your thoughts on some of the common themes that we tend to see running through a lot of spy movies going over whatever era.
If it's okay with you, I'd like to take that back to early espionage fiction or spy fiction, to the novels that emerged at the turn of the last century, so the beginning of the 20th century, because really they present a lot of the themes that become common later on and still are today. That genre, which really emerged here in the UK, but in other forms too, emerged in many ways as anti-Semitic, in that the notion was of a Britain, this was books coming out in 1903, 06, 09, that kind of period, that was subject to threats from within from foreigners. Now, foreigners meant Germans, but Germans meant Jews. And there are lots and lots of really disturbing and unpleasant characterization stereotypes of Jewish folks in the novels. When the First World War started, these novels became more and more and more popular. The idea of British counter-espionage not only became something that was popular in the public realm, but became something that was popular as part of statecraft as well. So suddenly the British, who had previously said that their empire was based on fair play and military and economic might and not on subterfuge, changed their tune and decided there was an enemy within, and no doubt some British anti-establishment anti-Semitism was part of that, and in fact drew in some of the people who'd written these novels as consultants. And that notion of paranoia, of lack of faith in your own nation, that there's an enemy within that connects to an enemy without, has been part of the kind of paranoid backdrop to a vast amount of espionage fiction ever since, whether we're talking about movies or TV or what you might read in the tabloids.
Now, that, of course, does run thick through both of the titles that we're discussing today, but particularly in Saboteur, which took us to America. But how do you think that those two themes play out when compared to American or British fiction?
Well, I think in terms of Hitchcock, you have a very interesting transatlantic character. Hitchcock was, of course, a London director who started out in the silent era, made some great espionage classics here in the UK before he moved to the US, had not been in the United States terribly long before he made Saboteur in 1942. And what's interesting about it is his ambivalence about everyday people and their trustworthiness. Because one of the themes that you get in a lot of not just crime fiction and espionage fiction, but sociology and anthropology and political science as well, in the early part of the 20th century through to the middle, is fear of the crowd, the idea that ordinary people cannot be trusted. And there are some sequences of mass panic in Saboteur, when there's a fire explosion, when the police announce there's a problem, when someone sets off fire extinguishers, sprinklers, and so on, when suddenly you see this everyday world become chaotic. And Hitchcock is making the point that you see in a lot of his fiction that the thin veneer of civilization that allows us to operate as ordinary people in a collective where we don't really know everybody, in a big city like New York City or Los Angeles or London, can in fact be shattered very easily. But on the other side of the ledger, there is also a faith in and a love of the everyday in Saboteur and in a lot of his fiction. So there will be people. There's a truck driver and there's a blind composer and pianist in Saboteur who instinctively trust our hero who is an accidental hero, who is regarded by almost everybody in the picture throughout its time as a villain, but who really is somebody who's fallen into an unfortunate escapade and who is the person who can save the United States from espionage. It is ordinary people who trust him, just as it is the ordinary people in a crowd who can get out of control and be bewildered. And that interesting oscillation or dynamic, I think, is very pertinent here.
Now, those are the sorts of things that you and I would tend to pick up when we watch films, because obviously you are also someone that looks at these things with quite an analytical scope. To a lot of people that just go along and see movies for entertainment, they wouldn't necessarily pick up on those details specifically. But they do have some sort of subconscious resonance, don't they? Because in my opinion, I think that they would go into impacting the way in which we view real-world politics and our real-world opinions of governments. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's no doubt that, as you say, film nerds like us notice things that others don't really care about, whether it's shot, reverse shot, or other editing conventions, whether it's the use of little models or of matte or projection into the background, all kinds of things that other people don't care about, we do care about. But of course, they're there to create the totality of the image and the story. And without those components, the story doesn't work. So we're all affected by them, whether we want to be or not. And in political terms, one of the interesting questions about Hitchcock in particular is that he's often seen as being, you know, a non-ideological director. He's making popular films for a general public that have these other kinds of messages that might be there, but by and large, their entertainments. And yet in the case of Saboteur, for example, at its major first screening, its premiere in the United States, there were dozens of high military brass in attendance. Dorothy Parker was one of the screenwriters, one of the sort of grand dame of the bon mot and witty take. There are fascinating gender elements. There are moments of hortatory speech in it when people make grand statements, both men and women, about the importance of loyalty, the importance of freedom, the significance of the United States, the tragedy of France being occupied, the sense of love of country and love of liberty, love of democracy. These things are very overt and they are there, but they don't detract from a rip-roaring story, a narrative that, you know, is impelled along very cleverly through all the movie trickery you'd expect. In The Ypres File, the heroic figure is someone who actually is a low-level spy, a former member of the British military, who is a public servant, a civil servant. And in fact, there's a little moment when he haggles over a tiny pay raise to just over £1,000 a year, which even in 1965 in London wasn't exactly excessive. At the same time, he too has this element, even though he's within the bureaucracy of the Secret Service, of being a bit of a lone wolf, of somebody who takes it upon himself rather than going through authority structures to do the right thing. And in many ways, the film ends through his being able to do that. So I think even though people might think of the 40s during the war as a time when even the United States had a notion of the importance of government and pulling together and a oneness and the significance of institutions in the context both of the horrors of the war and of the depression that had come before it, and then moving forward to 60s Britain, when you think of the notion of old Labour running the country, the idea of a very fulsome and effective welfare state where government is involved in it in all parts of everyday life, where unions are powerful, where employment is meant to be lifelong, a very different story from the one we confront 50 years later. Nevertheless, there are elements in both films of this notion of the individual who cannot be constrained or contained by either the state apparatus or by all the other kinds of authority figures that dominate their world.
Well, coming up soon, we'll take a closer look at two films that depict spies and espionage at two very different points in history. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, back right after this short break.
For our next Monocle Property Prospectus film, we head to Zurich's Kreisfeier. Once a red light district, its maverick and vibrant character now inspire designers and entrepreneurs to move into the neighborhood.
You have this grand mix of everything, and you always see some crazy things or some inspiring things. And even though it's not the most sane commercial decision, it was just clear, this is the vibe. And obviously the benefit is because it's exciting, it's also changing.
Zurich's unexpected new hood, Kreisfeier, is now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And of course, the new film by Italian director Paolo Sorrentino hits cinemas in many parts of the world today. Youth stars Michael Caine, Harvey Keitel, Rachel Weisz and the wonderful Jane Fonda. It's a wonderfully meditative look at nostalgia and coming to terms with the past, despite however grand your achievements may be. And to celebrate the release, MUBI is putting on a special Michael Caine show, a Caine triple threat, if you will. The Eagle Has Landed from 1976, The Quiet American from 2002, and naturally, 1965's The Ypres File. Toby, do you have a favourite Michael Caine performance?
He's a wonderful actor. He's a journeyman, as well as being brilliant. So there are lots of films where he's basically checked into the office for the day and he checks out at 5 and that's it. But there's always something striking and wonderful about him. And I must admit, The Ypres File is probably my favourite.
That is perfectly fitting then, because that, of course, is what we're going to chat about right now. So let's take ourselves back to another time then in London when it seemed to be crawling with covert men in stylish suits with shady looks on their faces.
You were bailed out of detention barracks.
Yes, I was.
So what bailed you in?
I was stationed in Berlin, and I was making rather a lot of money out of the German army, and they insisted that the British army made an example of me.
What did you do?
Oh, it's very complicated.
Seems to have impressed Ross.
Well, it impressed me. Boys, he got me by the short hairs for it. Still, it's better than 2 years in the nick. The food's terrible there.
Toby, this film was based on the well-regarded book by Len Deighton, who is actually from right here in Marylebone, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
The film puts Michael Caine in the leading role of an agent assigned to investigate a series of baffling disappearances of leading Western scientists. Caine is a wonderful choice for this role because, of course, his character, Harry Palmer, certainly doesn't see himself as a James Bond type, does he?
He has all sorts of connections to Bond by being Bond's other, if you like. So, for example, Harry Saltzman, the producer of the film, also produced some of the Bond films. Several other people working on the Bond pictures were involved. And by 1965, we've already had the dramatic successes of Dr. No and From Russia with Love and Goldfinger. And, of course, that's the Thunderball, which in up to that point is the most successful of them all in terms of box office is released. But they're fantasies. They were actually first categorized when they came out as science fiction movies. Dr. No was promoted in the US as a science fiction film, for example.
That's utterly bizarre, isn't it?
To our eyes, it is. Just as when you read about James Bond in both the East German media and the Catholic media, you were told that he was a wimp who embodied the collapse of the British Empire and the loss of UK masculinity. But nevertheless, there was a fantasy element, whereas there's a hard-bitten, cynical, tough, and above all, working-class kind of proletarian aspect to Caine's character as Harry Palmer. In addition to which, Sidney J. Fury, the director, again thought of as a journeyman director of no great consequence, I think an immensely talented person, uses all these things sometimes called Dutch angles or canted angles.
Yes.
People might associate with German expressionism or film noir.
Or perhaps even the Batman television series.
The Batman television series. Let's get to the heart of the matter, indeed, where it is quite clear from the way in which the movie is shot, no one's really certain what's going on, that you as the viewer have only a partial perspective again and again and again. And that partiality, added to by the fantastic music of John Barry, another Bond composer, of course, with his sort of quasi-ventures, quasi-Beach Boys, but slow version of beach rock as an instrumental chord progression, really gives it a hauntedness and a sense of a time of great flux in British life. And this is the moment when the Wilson Labour government had come into power the year before. It was promising a white technological heat, this was the term used, that would transform Britain from an old school industrial giant into a new school industrial giant, where British technology, British applied science would lead the country into the position of dominance that it had held globally from the late 19th century through to really the Depression. And those promises were the things that were put at risk and compromised in the story itself by the disappearance of these leading scientists.
It does feel as though this film has quite a different feel to Saboteur, the other film that we'll discuss in detail soon. But I would describe the way Hitchcock treats espionage and spies as quite as though the threat is imminent. There's quite a lot of suspense and you feel as though something could happen at any moment. Watching the Ypres file, it doesn't necessarily feel as though the threat is imminent. It's more of a lingering threat, something that perhaps has always been there and we're only just starting to understand what it is. And again, it's soon discovered in the film that each scientist has been brainwashed, so presumably that knowledge has been stolen. So again, we're picking up on those themes of paranoia here, aren't we?
We are. And we're also talking about the difference between a hot war and a cold war. So the cold war between, let us say, the West, as exemplified by Britain and the United States and the other members of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, versus the former Soviet Union or USSR and its satellite allies in Eastern and Central Europe. A war that never really took place other than by proxy and that involved a great deal of espionage, of military attaches in inverted commas, in all the embassies around Europe. And of course, because Europe is so easy to cross, vast numbers of people who were tourists or athletes or artists or whatever it might be, but a quiet word was had in their ear by the CIA or whatever other agency it might be, to say, by the way, old thing, when you're over there, would you mind just listening in and thinking about this, that, and the other? So there really were spies all over the place, but it didn't have the great outbursts of violence that other kinds of war do. So Hitchcock is dealing with the Second World War when it's already in play, when the war in the Asia-Pacific region with Japan is in play, the war in Europe with Germany is in play. This Cold War is much more internalized, interiorized, tense, bureaucratized, and part of everyday life. And one where there is a constant tension between the glamour of 60s Britain, the idea of swinging London and so on, that people like James Bond and the Beatles and the Avengers TV series helped to construct, and this notion of a country emerging from the horrendous experience of the Great Depression and the war, the loss of an empire, the loss of confidence, and the shrinking of its significance in economic terms. So there is both a sense of lamentation for a lost Britain, but the possibility of a new Britain in the context of its continued military significance and its strategic place in Europe at the heart of NATO's struggle with the USSR.
Well, let's talk about a new Britain then just for a moment and a new world, really. We often watch films like this with their very specific time settings and appearances, and we often view them as products of their time. But I would say that they're no less enjoyable for that. In fact, some of them can be more enjoyable. In the case of the Ypres file, however, what do you think it is about this particular film that makes it feel like it could be relevant to now?
Well, apart from the moments when he steps into telephone boxes to make phone calls, which sadly we no longer do. I go in them just to avoid the snow every now and then.
I think most people using telephone boxes in this city are probably taking a picture of themselves.
Amongst other things. Apart from that, a lot of it is very much of today. One of the ironies of the Harry Palmer character is that true, solid, proletarian son of the soil that he may be, he's also got immensely sophisticated, almost post-European Union membership notions of food. And in fact, there's a great moment when he breaks two eggs together in one hand. Len Deighton had to do this. Len Deighton was a great cook, also wrote cookery books. Michael Caine couldn't work out how to do it. So the sequence when you see a hand and it puts two egg shells together and breaks them. That's actually Dayton's hand. Right?
Fascinating.
And although he is, in a sense, a traditional male, Harry is obsessed with cooking. He grinds his own coffee. This is unheard of in 1965, but for Monocle listeners, readers, and no doubt employees, a completely common daily event.
Most definitely.
The other thing about it is that, and this is in common with the Bond films, in gender terms, it's quite interesting, in that, as is common in these films, women who are conventionally sexually attractive are not entirely trustworthy. They may or may not be sent to seduce a man by a higher spy authority. And yet, the idea that they would want sex with a man for pleasure without the notion of necessarily constructing a family or an ongoing relationship is there. And that's one of the things that the 60s really brings to cinema that wasn't present before and that again resonates today with the notion of the decoupling of sexual pleasure from full-blown ongoing responsibility. So I think there are all kinds of elements that are very much of today in that. The music is rhythmic and hummable and exciting. The acting is really quite extraordinary. And the pacing is interesting in that a lot of films you see from the 60s, including some of the Bond movies we touched on, are incredibly slow. I mean, Thunderball, coming out in 1965, barely watchable in the action sequences. The Ypres File has, for example, a very noted action scene, which is shot actually from within a telephone booth where you can barely see it. You're not certain who's fighting whom or how they're doing it. It's all shot in long shot and a reasonably long take. And yet there's something elegiac and exciting about it, precisely because as a viewer, you're struggling to understand what's going on. So I think there's actually an artiness to it that we can appreciate today and a pacing that is both of that era and our own.
I can't believe he wrote cookbooks and the Ypres File. Some people have far too much talent. And he can crack two eggs with one hand. Just ridiculous. Well, let's move on now to our second film today, Alfred Hitchcock's 1942 wartime thriller, Saboteur.
Why is it that you sneer every time you refer to this country? You've done pretty well here. I don't get it.
No, you wouldn't. You're one of the ardent believers, a good American. Oh, there are millions like you. People that plod along without asking questions. I hate to use the word stupid, but it seems to be the only one that applies. The great masses, the moron millions. Well, there are a few of us who are unwilling to just troop along. A few of us who are clever enough to see that there's much more to be done than just live small, complacent lives.
Now, here we have Robert Cummings playing Barry Kane, an aircraft factory worker who is accidentally embroiled in a high-stakes game of espionage after his friend is killed in a fire. Now, Toby, this film was written with lots of symbolism in mind. It came out in 1942 in the middle of the Second World War. There's even a wonderful moment involving an encounter with some circus freaks, for want of a better term, each of whom seem to represent different aspects of the world's conflict. What do you make of some of the symbolism we're seeing in this film?
I'm very glad you mentioned the so-called freaks scene because it's an important one about multiculturalism and tolerance and difference, which resonates today decades later. In this sequence, we see us, and I'm going to use the term so-called because some of these forms of talk may be offensive to some listeners and to some of the people described. Someone called a bearded lady, two women called Siamese twins, a person who is a very short person, a so-called fat lady, and also a man known as Skeleton. They are not exactly unanimous in their views of the Robert Cummings character whom they meet, Barry Kane, who is a fugitive from justice and yet, as we know, is actually innocent and is this person who is being thrust into heroic greatness. They decide to have a vote as to whether they will harbour him, protect him from the oncoming police. So in the circus troupe, they say, we're Democrats, small d. We believe that we should be able to come upon a reasonable consensus about what to do with this guy. The Siamese twins are divided in their affections for him. One votes to turn him over to the cops, one doesn't. Ultimately, it's a very close-run thing, but they decide to support him. And it's this notion of inclusiveness and difference that I think is a really striking aspect of the film that you see there. And again, when you see a disabled person, a blind person, who welcomes the Barry Kane character into his home, even though he realizes that this character is wearing handcuffs and therefore is probably a fugitive from the cops. So there's this remarkable sense of a groundswell of tolerance amongst those who are excluded from the mainstream. That is one of the nice aspects of Hitchcock's eye on America. He was very conscious when he arrived in Hollywood not long before making this film, and of course the film was made very soon after the US entered the war, which was the end of 1941, that there was a sense of artifice about Hollywood in terms of the way it represented the United States, the way that Hollywood would focus on normalcy, normalcy being trying to be as British as possible, trying not to be the Russian Jewish folks who'd actually made Hollywood as they'd come over from the Lower East Side, where they'd been farriers or movie house makers in New York, over to the West Coast, and who were the heads of the emergent and then dominant studios. They didn't want to be themselves with their Russian accents. They wanted everybody to have names like Toby Miller and Robert Cummings and to sound like I do, pretty much. That was the idea. And that normalcy was something that Hitchcock found quite repellent, but also fascinating. When he was asked by some of his British fans and friends, "Oh God, Alfred, how can you cope with all those bloody Americans? It must be awful over there." He replied, "I don't meet any. There are people from everywhere in Hollywood." And it's true. I lived in LA for most of the last 10 years. There are people from everywhere. And the dominant image of the sort of white, Western, Northern European person as the idée fixe of Hollywood in this classical era is undermined by these interesting other people who are so important, albeit in peripheral ways, in supporting the hero of Saboteur.
That particular expression of symbolism, that it all takes place on the Statue of Liberty, I think is probably the strongest element coming out of the film, and that it has to be one of the loudest messages that Alfred Hitchcock ever really put into any of his films, doesn't it?
I think so. And actually, if I could drop in at this point, one of the people involved in that sequence is Norman Lloyd. Norman is still going strong at 101 in LA, and I'm proud to say I know him, a wonderful, wonderful person. And when I had lunch with him a couple of years ago, I did ask him about Hitchcock and patriotism, actually. And he said, look, we were desperate. It was a bad time. 42 was a bad time. Okay, the Battle of Britain had been won, but the Japanese at that point were still dominant in the Asia-Pacific region. It wasn't clear how quickly the United States could industrialize. It wasn't entirely clear whether or not the Eastern Front was going to sink Hitler in terms of opposition from the USSR. These were desperate days. But at the same time, Hitchcock had what I'm calling a profound ambivalence towards rah-rah US nationalism, and certainly towards British imperialism too. I mean, he was a lower middle class guy. He wasn't in any sense part of the British elite. And according to Norman, that certainly suffused a lot of the ambiguity in the film, even though there are clearly good guys and bad guys in the movie, but they're also confusing people who might be a little way in between. And, of course, in the film, we also see the American ruling class, including traitors amongst its midst. So I think there is a great deal of fascination we can discern there in Hitchcock's ambiguous take on US life.
Well, that just about brings us to the end of this week's edition of The Cinema Show. My special thanks to my guest today, the social scientist and author Toby Miller. He's written a whole number of books. One of them, in fact, is about the Avengers, not the superhero team. Of course, the classic British television series, The Real Avengers, if you will. So have a look out for that as well. The Cinema Show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yulene Goffin. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch with me by sending an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Reilly. Thanks for listening.